Now, there are certainly a lot of similarities amongst farmers, but there's no denying the fact that every farm is different. Never is that more apparent than when you learn about a farming operation in a different part of the country than where you're from. Our guest today, for example, shares about his cover crop experiences down in Louisiana.
It's worked out really well so far. Like I said, it's cut down on erosion. I hadn't had a whole super lot of weed pressure. So far, it's been working good. Like I said, I'm kind of wanting to get into some of the other cover crops that cost a little more, just for the fact of I want to try to do a little experimenting with the nitrogen savings on it.
Louisiana farmer Garrett Marsh joins the show to share some of his early experiences with cover crops, why he switched from flooding to row rice and how that fits into his rotation, and some of the farming approaches that are unique to his area. This is the Soil Sense podcast, where we believe that building healthier soils is not just a prescription, but rather a pursuit. On this show, we unpack the ways farmers collaborate to build healthier soils and adapt systems to work on their farm for both sustainability and profitability. Let's get to the root of all that and cover some ground on today's episode of Soil Sense. Hey there, thanks for tuning in to Soil Sense. I'm one of your hosts, Tim Hamrich. Joining me, of course, is our co-host, Dr. Abby Wick, and we're sitting down today with Louisiana farmer Garrett Marsh. Garrett and his wife farm near Tallulah, Louisiana, which is just across the Mississippi River from Vicksburg, Mississippi, in Madison Parish, which is in the northeast part of Louisiana there. His grandfather started out sharecropping in the area, so he's now the third generation of his family to farm that land. They farm around 1,700 acres of soybeans, corn, rice, wheat, and cotton. Now, if you're not familiar with that part of the country, you're especially in for a treat today, because while there are a lot of similarities with farming elsewhere, there also are some really stark differences. We cover some of those differences while also discussing with Garrett his soil health journey, a little bit on row rice, and where he hopes to take things on his farming operation when it comes to soil health in the future. Garrett begins our conversation by talking about how a lifelong interest in soil eventually led him to try cover crops.
We've always tried to take care of soil. I mean, that's what takes care of us. I mean, if we don't have good soil health, then, you know, we're not going to have a good crop. But I would say I've tried to start paying closer attention to it. We used to do occasional soil testing, but now I've kind of implemented across our entire farm to where, you know, we basically have a three-year rotation that we're testing every acre that we have every 3 years. And because of soil testing, you know, we've realized some stuff that we're kind of behind on, and we're, you know, we've brought some stuff up to regular levels where we can start back to maintenance levels as far as applying, you know, phosphorus and potash and stuff like that. But just trying to pay more attention to it, definitely. Just for the fact right now that as expensive as crops are to raise, you're trying to get every advantage you can get to get that extra bushel.
And what brought on the soil testing to begin with? Was there a specific question or a specific concern you had that started it? Or was it just you kind of heard about it and thought it'd be a good idea?
Well, it's something I've kind of always wanted to do. Like I said, some of the land that I've got, you know, I mean, we've always made good crops on it. But like I said, it's just something that, you know, I really started on it trying to get more yield out of the acres that I got. Like I said, around here, it's harder to get more land. So you got to do better with the land you got. So that's what we've been trying to do is look more into how we can get more out of the few acres that we do have.
What is that? You said you grow corn, soybean, and some cotton and some rice. And so what does that look like for your practices and the way you've adopted cover crops into that rotation?
Well, I'm kind of still early on in the cover crop deal. I guess one of my surprises since I've jumped into it is how expensive cover crops are down here. The good ones that I want anyway, you know, I mean, you can get, you know, wheat cover crops and stuff like that, which is what a lot of folks have been using down here, you know, during the winter, and just because it's the cheapest, but it's not necessarily, I guess, the most beneficial. You know, it helps for erosion and stuff like that. But as far as really soaking up any nutrients and returning them back in the spring, it's not really helpful. But that's kind of what we've been doing lately. I've tried to get some other types of cover crops just to do it, but like I said, it's just kind of limiting on the what they cost right now. I don't know how they are up north, but down here it's kind of hard to get some of the ones that are more beneficial.
I'm really intrigued by rice just because I know so little about it. Is there anything soil related there that's a unique issue to rice, or that I don't know if anybody's even doing things like, or if you even could do like a cover crop with rice. I'm not sure what the opportunity is there. Just curious.
Well, with rice, I don't think you're going to have to do a cover crop. It's got so much biomass left over anyway, because basically it's a little over waist high crop at maturity, and it's really thick. Most of the time it's flooded. Down south, it's pretty much always flooded. Up here in North Louisiana and Arkansas, it's traditionally always been a flooded crop. A lot of folks now, me included, have gone to what they call row rice. It fits into my crop rotation easier as far as, you know, thinking about the next year and the cost of trying to get rid of levees and pick up gates, and just labor wise, row rice is a lot better. But like I said, the crop itself is a real thick crop anyway. And like I said, all you're doing is cutting the head off of it, and then all the rest of it is still standing. And you can actually leave that standing over the wintertime. And, you know, a lot of folks will flood it, duck hunt on it, stuff like that. But I mean, it's still, you know, it's almost waist high all the way through the winter unless you run a roller or something over it or try to shred it.
So how is rice used as a rotational crop? I mean, so you have all these, I know nothing about it either, but you have these levees, right? So you can flood the field, or this row rice, you don't need levees and you can just plant it on a field and maybe irrigate it? Or what does that look like?
Like I said, normally, you know, you got to kind of got a fall on your, either that or a zero grade field, and you put levees on it and flood it up. But like I said, you got all the levees to deal with. You've got gates, and like I said, it's just, it gets kind of labor intensive, whereas where we're at, we put everything on rows around here anyway. Rice is normally a flat crop. Well, we've got to where you have to do everything in the fall around here because you can't get into the fields in the spring because it's so wet. So we'll just row everything up like we normally do with all of our other crops, and then we'll come in the spring and you'll just drill right into those rows. You don't want real tall rows, but like I said, we'll either drag them down or something like that, and then just enough where you can furrow irrigate it. We use poly pipe, rollout pipe, and furrow irrigate everything. It's two sides, I guess, to row rice. You've got some people that stop the end of the field up and they keep the water on the lower end and they just kind of irrigate ever so often, you know, that you try to keep those roots wet. I'm kind of like the other side to where I don't stop my field up, but I don't let a lot of water run off anyway, because you're just wasting water if you let it run off. Because my feeling is if you leave it stopped up at the bottom, then you have half a field that is flooded. Your middle half is what they would consider alternate wet drying, which is kind of a different management. And then the top half is dry. And when you're putting fertilizer and stuff on it, I mean, that's basically three different zones you're managing in three different times. As farming, we're always trying to treat everything the same and uniform, and it's just hard to manage the other way. But like I said, it's you're just flooding it. Just like me, watering it just like you would corn or soybeans down here. You know, not everything's irrigated, but the stuff that can be irrigated, you either have a pivot or you have rollout polypipe. And I would say that most everybody uses polypipe now. Even, you know, folks have got away from pivots unless it's some real rolling ground.
And so a field of row rice this year, what will you go into that field in next year?
Most people do a rice soybean rotation.
That's really cool. I didn't know about that. I always thought about rice as just the flooded with the levees and the gates and everything you mentioned, but that's really cool.
Up here we do a rice soybean rotation. You go down south where it's flooded all the time, they actually have a rice crawfish rotation. They'll actually go in and like I said, leave that stubble up, and then the next year they'll put out crawfish traps and farm crawfish on it.
That sounds like a lot of work, crawfish.
Well, a lot of folks are set, you know, down there, they're set up for it, and it's good money. Like I said, it just depends on the year. You know, sometimes they'll have good years, sometimes they have bad years, but crawfish is a big thing down here. And it used to be pretty much just in Louisiana, but you got a lot in South Texas now, and there's some Mississippi, and they've got trucks running from South Louisiana delivering crawfish all the way up in Arkansas and stuff. So, I mean, there's folks that's, I guess it's growing.
Yeah, absolutely. That's really cool. Well, on the cover crops, you said, you know, it's just been the last few years you've been experimenting with them. What have you seen out of that? I mean, you mentioned the surprise at how much it costs and looking for some different species to use, but have you seen any results so far?
I have. It helps the erosion. I guess one of my biggest concerns going into it was weed control. You know, we have a lot of pigweed and barnyard grass and stuff like that, and I was just scared that I was going to be carrying that over. You know, I know they were saying that it would shade a lot of that stuff out, but you still get some. I've heard of some folks planting into the live cover crop. I don't know anybody that does that down here just yet. I don't necessarily know whether it works with our cropping system down here. Around here, we start planting, you know, probably last week of February, early March. So, you know, we'll come in late January, early February, and do our regular burn down. And I've planted straight into it. I've tried rolling, stuff like that. I don't know. It's kind of scary to me sometimes planting into like a tall cover crop like that. It just seems like it wouldn't do real good. But then I try to remind myself of, you know, we're double cropping wheat, you know, soybeans behind wheat. And it's the same way. You plant into it and you look and you don't really see anything out there. But, you know, eventually it starts, your crop starts growing above that. So I kind of try to keep that in my mindset. And it's worked out really well so far. Like I said, it's cut down on erosion. I hadn't had a whole super lot of weed pressure. So far, it's been working good. Like I said, I'm kind of wanting to get into some of the other cover crops that cost a little more, just for the fact of I want to try to do a little experimenting with the nitrogen savings on it. I know some folks around here that had, they were doing the tillage radishes, and those seemed to work out pretty good, you know, as far as breaking your soil up and stuff. But of course, we don't have a lot of problem with that. What we have a what we call buckshot down here is basically heavy clay, and was what mostly what I farm. I'm sure your sandy ground and stuff, it would help out, but the heavy clay that we have cracks anyway. I mean, you get during the summer when it's real dry, you can drop a crescent wrench and can't get it. It's in the ground. It's some deep cracks. So it's pretty much kind of self-tilling itself, but people kind of got away from the tillage radishes unless you were out in the real rural areas, because I know some folks around here that did it around neighboring houses, and they get kind of stinky in the springtime when they start rotting. They had a lot of complaints with them.
It sounds like with double cropping and your season is already, it probably never ends. I mean, are you continuously farming, you know, 12 months of the year or?
No. Nowadays we're through harvesting by October. Usually, you know, our last crop we're getting out is cotton down here, and everything we've learned, we've tried to start planting earlier. I remember when I was little growing up, I mean, it wasn't nothing. We'd be cutting beans in November and December, but mostly everything's a group four down here now. There's a couple of folks around here that are planting beans. They got a planter planting beans and a planter planting corn at the same time, which is kind of scary because we're still around that frost time, you know, this year. I know this year we got in early for the first time in a long time planting corn, and it was that first week of March, and it was pretty beautiful. Soil temperature was perfect. Everything come up, got a pretty stand, and then we got a freeze, and like a good freeze. It got down to about 26 for overnight. And it smoked everything that was up real tall, and ended up, had a lot of folks had to replant. So we've got some younger corn around here right now.
What I'm sure you, you know, in your work with Soybean Board and in other organizations, you probably talk to a lot of people from the I states or from, you know, the northern part. What do you tell them about how farming is different in Louisiana than it probably is where they live?
Well, seems like it's a complete different thing. It's also the reverse too, because it's uncanny to me talking to some of those folks about them talking about having to, they're cutting corn in December and January and stuff, and they're talking about having to, I forget, one of them told me one time that they generally want it to be like 23 or something. I forget what temperature they told me now when they're cutting corn, because they said that the snow will just go all the way through the combine. If it's any warmer than that, then they stop their screens up and they got to go pull their combine in a shed and thaw it out. That is way out of where we're at. we're actually finna to start harvest here at the end of this month. And like I said, currently today's high here is 99 degrees actual temperature. And, you know, I mean, we're wishing it would be a little chilly, not quite that chilly though. But yeah, it's different. You know, even around here, it amazes me sometimes how far apart different planting times are. You know, you can go just 50 miles west of here, and I've got friends that are, you know, they're about 2 weeks behind us. And you figure, you know, I mean, you're the same latitude. You figure that you would, you know, be pretty close to the same, but it's different just 50 miles away from you. And you get further north like that, and it's, you know, people are talking about like group one beans and stuff like that. And I'm like, that just blows my mind. I didn't even know they made a group one bean. One of the biggest difference that I've, you know, dealt with on the soybean board, I guess, you know, we've been promoting high oleic for a long time and stuff like that, but you don't have a lot of that adoption down here. And, you know, of course we can't get a premium for it. We don't have a crush facility down here. As far as I know, the only crush facility that's anywhere close is about 4 hours south of me in Destrehan. Bungie has a little small crush facility there on one of their export elevators. Other than that, everything's up, you know, our closest one's like Indiana. So, I mean, they get a lot of the crush market premiums. They get a lot of ethanol plants and some premiums for different specialty crops, whereas we don't get that down here. Most of our corn stays here. It all goes to chicken mills. They grind it into feed for chickens and cows and stuff around here. The rest of it, we've got a facility pretty nearby that actually ships to Mexico via rail. I'd almost say 100% of our soybeans go straight on a barge and they go south and they're exported as whole beans. So that's where most of your differences come from, is, you know, their marketing and stuff like that. I guess it always surprises me as to how different our markets and stuff are.
And what about for soil health? Where do you see opportunities? Because you're in a more unique context than somebody who might be in Iowa or Illinois who maybe share a lot of similarities. Where do you see opportunities for healthier soils in the Delta region?
To my knowledge, like I said, a lot of this, what I call buckshot, heavy clay, we actually have a lot of more organic matter and stuff, I think, than they do up north, just naturally, because, I mean, that's pretty much what our heavy clay is just an alluvial soil from the river flooding years ago. But like I said, I mean, all of our corn stubble and stuff, like, you know, used to, you had a lot of folks that burnt a lot of that stuff off. And they still do have some people around here that do that. I try to disc all mine in just for the organic matter and stuff in it. But I'm trying to keep all the organic matter and stuff that I can in my soil. I think most of your sandy ground definitely needs it more, you know, and that's where a lot of your more intensive management is around here, is in your sandier ground. Like I said, I've never farmed up north, so I don't necessarily know all their peculiarities, but I know that, you know, I know they always seem to deal with talking about, you know, low organic matter, and we don't really have that problem. Whereas most all our stuff, we're trying to manage your nitrogen and runoff and stuff like that. And we're like, that's kind of a big thing with our rice. You lose a lot of nitrogen and a lot of that stuff in your water that's flowing out of your back end of your field. I don't like to lose a lot of that. I like to keep it in the field, because when you see that water running out the back culvert, then you're basically losing a lot of your nutrients in that ditch, which I know as far as, you know, DEQ, EPA, stuff like that, they're trying to regulate a lot of that stuff too. The state of Louisiana, we're trying to do a lot of this stuff voluntarily, I guess. And I think a lot of folks around here have improved a lot on their water management and their nutrient management and not losing it to ditches. And because all of our water, which I'd say probably all of y'all's water, wherever y'all are at, probably ends up down here in the Mississippi River and in the Gulf. And, you know, you get what they call the hypoxic zone down there. And like I said, all that stuff is, I think it's getting a little bit better. I mean, stuff's just too expensive to be losing anyway. That's probably the main drive to save a lot of this nutrients that's coming out of your soil. And cover crops helps that. Like I said, it'll take up some of that and keep it in the field till the next year.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like you've been working hard to rebuild some of those nutrients in your soil so you can get to maintenance levels. And so using whatever practices to keep that soil in the field and to recapture those nutrients is probably what's driving you. How has technology helped you with that as well? If you're doing cover crops plus the fertility management, and technology is probably in there as well.
Yeah, it's definitely a big part of my farm now. I guess I was the first one to start using GPS for auto steer a long time ago in my family. I remember my uncles and stuff telling me that nobody needed that expensive stuff. And then they watched me. I was actually rowing up, and I was actually helping them row up some ground. And, you know, back in the day when you used row markers, you were just completely wore out by the end of the day, you know, trying to stay straight all the time. And, you know, I was rowing up all day and part of the night, which you couldn't have ever rowed up at night because you couldn't see your row mark. And I'd get off and I felt just like I did when I got on the tractor. And it was the next year, I think every one of their tractors ended up had GPS. And it's kind of grown from there. Most of all my stuff I keep on my computer, try to keep my yield maps. I'm trying to do better with that, keeping up with your yield maps and stuff and comparing some of this stuff. That's kind of why I've been kind of wanting to experiment with some of the your nutrient-saving cover crops, just to do, you know, do some side-by-side comparisons and see, you know, exactly how much nitrogen you are saving with them. Because, I mean, nitrogen is, especially in corn, is one of your largest inputs and probably three-quarters of your inputs, you know. And if you can save some of that and cut back on your nitrogen, not only are you helping, you know, run off in the soil, but you're also saving, putting dollars in your own pocket.
Anything else that related to your soil health journey that you think would be helpful to include on this as we start to kind of wrap things up here? Just anything you're doing or thinking about that you think might be of interest to others who are also thinking about soil health and cover crops and that sort of thing?
Not that I could think of. Like I said, I'm kind of early on in this too. I know there was a lot of folks around here that jumped off in it and planted a whole bunch of cover crops. And then I think a lot of them were, you know, the planting the next year that was always the hardest part, trying to plant, learn how to plant into that cover crop. We've been so long around here doing conventional till, you know, everybody's used to a pretty made up seed bed. And, you know, you're kind of going straight from conventional till to no till real quick. And like I said, people have kind of got a little scared, hard plan, didn't get good stands. Rather than jumping off into it head first and planting every acre you got in it, you know, I would suggest just kind of starting off slow, a couple of fields, you know, and experiment with them and see how you like it. Because, I mean, it's different for everybody. It really is. You know, your neighbor is going to do something different than what you are. And you just got to find the little niche that's right for you. And there's no doubt that it's beneficial just from the fact of, you know, I found in, you know, since I started doing it, you know, you come back, like I said, we row everything up down here. So you start off in the fall and have you a nice, pretty tall bed. And then you come back in the spring to plant and you look at cover crops versus your stale seed bed. And your stale seed bed, you got like a 3 or 4 inch row left sitting there from where it's done rained on it all, you know, winter and done kind of eroded it down. And then you look at cover crops and it's just like it was when you planted it. It's almost too tall and you got to come down and, you know, roll all that stuff down. So, I mean, it's benefit definitely for erosion. And the weed control thing, I'm still kind of riding on. I'm on the fence. Not just, I guess, weed control, but one of the other things that I hadn't really ever said anything about is what's different from us in the Midwest is also our insect pressure. And you get into insect pressure down here is ridiculous compared to what they have up north. And it's still kind of up in the air to me as to whether you're creating that bridge, what they call the green bridge, to you know, come into your crop. You know, normally everything's dead before we plant and most of your insects have kind of died or gone off somewhere, you know, and they don't come back till, you know, about this time in the season, which, you know, with cover crops, you're kind of given what they call that green bridge to where your insects are, you know, they're just carrying over into your crop, you know, right off. And it's not necessarily something we can't deal with, but it's something that's definitely you need to pay attention to because you're going to have to scout more earlier and you're going to have to, you know, maybe put in some more insecticide applications earlier. Like I said, it's not a bad thing. It's just something that you need to plan for. I guess, you know, it's change. Nobody likes change. You kind of got to adapt to it. So,
well, very interesting point there to end on, and really one that we haven't talked enough about on the show, which is this impact on insect and disease pressure and management strategies for that. So that's a great point to maybe explore on a future episode of this show. So thank you very much to Garrett Marsh for taking the time for this interview. Incredibly fascinating to hear about farming in Louisiana. I wasn't really familiar with row rice. I'd always seen flooded rice in fields growing up in Northern California, and ideas like a rice crawfish rotation are kind of mind-blowing to me, so really, really enjoyed that. Before we close, I do want to thank the Soy Checkoff for sponsoring this Farmers for Soil Health series of the Soil Sense podcast. This show is produced by Dr. Abby Wick, Dr. Olivia Cayuette, and myself, with support from the United Soybean Board, the University of Missouri Center for Regenerative Agriculture, and the Soil Health Institute. If you're at all interested in what soil health looks like in practice and on the farm, I highly suggest you subscribe and follow this show on your favorite podcast app and go ahead and leave us a rating and review while you're there. Also, be sure to check out the Farmers for Soil Health website at farmersforsoilhealth.com. Until next time, stay curious, keep collaborating, and don't forget to take a minute to stop and smell the soil. Have a good one.